Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying. This is the podcast which you'll know by now is designed to banish some of the taboos around talking about death and dying. And I started it when I first became a widow and didn't really know where to turn. And I should have found the Widow's Handbook at that point, which was founded by somebody called Suzanne Elvidge, but I didn't find it. But luckily I found her now. So I'm very pleased to say I'm talking to Suzanne this morning. Would you like to start by telling me why you decided this was a good idea to start a widow's handbook?
I was widowed very suddenly at 50. My husband had type 2 diabetes. And while we knew he wasn't necessarily going to make old bones, didn't expect it to happen. And one morning he was just in bed to me, next to me, and his heart stopped. And it was that sudden, that unexpected, and it feels like the world has been swept out from underneath you. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to find the charity Widowed and Young, and they were amazing. It was full of people who were in my situation, not in my situation, but understood in a completely different situation. But there's a something in common. And that really helped me. But what I found is that there weren't necessarily the resources out there for somebody widowed, fairly young, no children by choice, in that very sudden, unexpected situation. And for a while, I've been thinking about writing something. I'm a writer by trade, and it's how I communicate. And so one day, I just thought, that's a topic, there's nothing about out there about it. And I started writing the blog. And it's just gone on from there. It was started probably about 2 years after I was widowed, because before then, my head didn't work and I wasn't in the right place. I'd also found that I write fiction for part of my life. And I'd found that I lost the ability to write fiction. And so it was a way for me to start writing again. And that was therapeutic as well. I wanted it to be something that was useful for people. I wanted it to talk about the things that people don't necessarily talk about. So there's a touch of the personal in there. I talk about my story in there. But largely, it's information, it's practical information that's broken down into small pieces, because I know that the brain fog set in and I couldn't read anything long. The thought of picking up a book was just impossible. I just couldn't do that. And so I wanted this to be single topics that you could dip in and out of. So they're everything from one of the most popular ones, which interested me, is the one on widow's fire, which is people wanting intimacy after being bereaved. And I'd felt this and no one was talking about it. Mm-hmm. And clearly no one was talking about it because it's the one that gets the most hits. But also there's things about when you take your wedding ring off, if you take your wedding ring off, what's normal and what isn't normal. And the conclusion I came from is that if we're feeling it, it's normal. Different models of grief, because people have been talking to me about the stages of grief, which aren't the stages of grief at all. They're the stages of people acknowledging their own forthcoming death. But different models of grief, some of which really helped me, some of which I found not helpful at all, but I figured that some people might. So I talk about different ways to grieve. Some of them are little tiny, tiny things, because it occurs to me, oh, what about that? Some of them take days and days to write because there's a lot of information in there. But the main thing I want to get across is that there are other people in the same situation and what you feel is probably normal.
It's right for you.
Absolutely. I do remember posting up something quite early on the Widowed and Young group, saying that some days I can cope absolutely perfectly well and some days I fall apart and am I doing it wrong? And that's where I came across this idea that no, because if that's how you're grieving, it's not wrong. And it just helps so much. But yes, I wanted to kind of be the place that people could go to and think, I wonder if anybody else has felt like this. And just go and say, I'm having problems with the grief and the menopause. And there's a piece about that. Or I feel like I'm still grieving like I did on day one. And this is day 430. Why do I feel that? And there's something about that. So I suppose I thought, if I feel like this about a subject, somebody else probably is. So I provide that answer for them. And sometimes it's just me wanting an answer for myself. And I think, well, I might as well write it down because somebody else might want it.
So what you described is one of the tools used in counselling, isn't it? It's to normalise things for people.
That makes sense, yes.
And the more you read about what other people are going through, the more normal you feel.
Mm. It seems to be the thing that people do seem to say is that, is it normal to feel like this? Because there are a few people I know who have been lost a partner more than once, and that's heartbreaking. But for most of us, this is the first time something as monumental as losing your partner has happened. And so we don't have a toolkit for it because we've not been through it before. And our society doesn't always talk about it as well.
That's why we're both here.
Absolutely.
Can we go back to that, what you said about intimacy? Because that's something that resonates with me. And I'm not talking about full intimacy necessarily. I'm talking about the fact that, I mean, like you describe losing your husband lying in bed beside you. There was no longer a hand to touch, to hold. And that's such a visual image that you see in films reproduced all the time, isn't it? Somebody lying in bed alone, reaching out a hand, looking for the hand that they used to hold. And it's that very basic thing of not having a hand, not having someone just to give you a hug when you need a hug. Yeah. And that's making me want to cry now, because I suppose I feel that lack a lot.
Yeah. Tim died not too long before lockdown. He died in early 2018. And so I was going through lockdown in a house on my own. And I remember in I don't know whether it was the end of lockdown or it must have been one of the gaps in lockdown, going to an exercise class, going to a Pilates class. And the tutor just reaching out a hand to adjust my position slightly.
Oh.
And I nearly cried because someone was touching me. And it's that, the way I've heard it described is skin hunger. And that want to be, and you say it can range from, at one end, it's about missing sex and really, really wanting sex. At the other end, it's the hand on your shoulder saying, do you want a cup of tea? And it's all about touch. And I'm a really quite touchy-feely person. If I was talking to you now, I'd probably put my hand on your arm or something like that. I'm all about touch and contact, and I'm very, very huggy and that sort of thing. And so not having that was, and I really didn't expect that. And a lot of things I write about are, oh, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. I particularly notice it when I go to funerals, and sadly I've had to been to a few funerals recently. I always used to have a hand to hold then, because that's a great support if you know you're going somewhere really sad. Yeah, I miss that.
I went to a funeral just a few weeks after Tim died, and a friend, very, very dear friend, Fiona, came along, and she stood next to me and she held my hand, and we arranged it so that I was sitting at the back near the end of the pew, so I could just slip out if I needed to. But just having, again, it's that unconscious reaching out for someone's hand. And it seems like something tiny, but it's huge, absolutely huge.
And you've mentioned there another key lesson, I think, for widows and widowers, which is the exit strategy. It's important to have those in so many circumstances,
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
The times I would go to something and make sure, like a party or something, and I'd try and arrive early, and I'd arrange that I could arrive early so I could see if there was somewhere that I could escape to, somewhere quiet, so I can meet people one by one, not meeting them, not walking into a crowded room and meeting them all at once. And driving rather than relying on lifts or public transport or anything like that, so that I knew that if I needed to get out, I could just go. And also telling the host that I might just disappear and no, nothing was wrong. And no, I just, there might be a point where I needed to escape. And that was important. Also, I've been in a situation like that where I've booked a taxi, knowing that I could cancel the taxi if I was having a lovely time. But if I wasn't having a lovely time, I could say, oh, is that the time? My taxi's arriving in 5 minutes.
How long was it, can you remember, before you went to a party? Because I think that's something people often talk about with me. They initially, you don't want to go into public at all, do you? But you certainly don't want to go and be surrounded by people you may or may not know and have to answer questions that you may not be prepared for.
I think going to a party where I didn't know people was a year or two. I did go to one earlier that was somebody's big milestone birthday, but I knew that I would know absolutely everyone there. It was local, it was in the next village, so I could walk or drive quite easily. So I had that strategy put in. But yeah, it was a year or two before I went to a big, I might not know anyone there kind of party. I've never been terribly good at going to big, I don't know anyone parties anyway, but going to one of those where you might have to explain yourself or you didn't have someone there with you. It was big and it did take time.
It is that explaining yourself business, isn't it? You kind of feel that you've got this bit of information which is terribly private to you.
Oh, absolutely. I know one of the questions I really dreaded people saying to me was, how did he die? Because it's kind of, I don't want to tell you.
It's yours.
Why does it matter? It's mine. And also explaining the difference between, he didn't have a heart attack. His heart just failed. It just catastrophically stopped. It wasn't a chest clutching pain. It was just a stop. And just not wanting to explain that. And it's made me very conscious how I talk to other people whose partner has died. It's made me really conscious about what I do say and how I react to them, because you learn through what's happened to you. I don't know if that's answered the question, but yes.
So what are the things you've learned to say and not to say?
It sucks. I will just sometimes just say, it sucks. This is horrible. I try not to say, I know how you feel, because I don't. I try not to give advice, because I had so much unsolicited advice. I just try and be there, and I try and remember to be there a day later, a week later, a month later. I'll send a message 6 months later saying, how are you doing? And also trying not to ask, how are you? Because I developed a number of answers to that. I developed just plodding on, or you know how it is, or I don't know how I feel. It depended on who I was. Because sometimes you just want to say something to deflect it. But some people genuinely do want to know. But the being there and saying, I am here for you, and genuinely showing up after that was critical, because I had people saying, I'm here for you. Oh, the other thing I try not to say is there anything I can do for you? Because people would say that to me, and I don't know. Do you mean that you'll be there, or do you mean that you'll bring round a 47 lasagnas, or do you mean that you'll actually come round and clean the house for me because I can't cope? And one of the best pieces of advice I got was to get a packet of post-it notes and a Sharpie. And every time I thought of something that I did actually, it would actually be really useful if someone did for me, I wrote it down on a Sharpie. And if somebody said, is there anything I can do? I could say, those are the things I need doing. If you can do any of those, that would be wonderful. And so they'd take the post-it note away. And that was, because it's the practical things, it's the making sure that you've let so-and-so know, or cancelling the dental appointments, those kinds of things. And just being able to write those down and say, can you do that for me, was so helpful.
I love that idea, and I love the idea of the note being transportable so they can take it with them. And then it's off your list. It's gone.
It's off my list, and I don't have to be reminded. It's even better than crossing it off, because once it's off the wall, it's gone.
And this business of being there and being there for a long time and saying that 6 months later and 9 months later and so on, how good did you find people were at being there for you?
Generally good. One thing I found was that some of the people I expected would be there weren't as there as I expected. But some of the people I didn't expect were amazing, utterly, utterly incredible. And our friendships have grown and deepened because of that. And so sometimes your people aren't necessarily the people you expect them to be. And some of them are just, you realise who are the incredible people. I actually found very few people disappeared. But I know, talking to other widows, that there were people who found that friends and sometimes even family disappeared. There are people who completely lost touch with their in-laws. Friends would even cross over the road to avoid talking to them, that sort of thing. And that broke my heart. And I was very, very fortunate that I didn't have that happen. I still talk to Tim's mum. When you do the, oh, can you tell Sue that? So I'll talk to his mum and pass messages on to his sister and that sort of thing. So it's that relationship's still there. But there are some people that completely lost half their family, half their friends when the partner died. It's so sad, that time when you need things more than ever before and they're gone. And as I said, I don't understand.
No, it's cruel, actually, isn't it?
It is.
But I know you've gone on to have another relationship, and I'd like to talk about that, because one of the things that struck me going through some of your blog pieces was somebody saying, how can you ever love somebody again? And then someone saying, it's a bit like when you have more children, your love expands. And I thought that was such a lovely analogy.
I loved that one. It was, can't think who it was, but yes, you don't stop liking your original friends when you get new friends. It was really striking, because it was difficult working out when I was in a place to start thinking about another relationship. And when I'm talking to the people about this, I always want to say that for some people, they won't ever have another relationship, and that's fine. Some people will have another relationship within months, and that's fine. Some people will wait years to have another relationship, and that's fine. It's all fine. It's everybody's different. My wife's also a widow. And so that helped, because we get it. And we both talk about our previous partners. And it was complicated around the time, but it was subconsciously complicated. When we started getting together, I had some really weird dreams. I had some really quite upsetting dreams. I had some really quite confusing dreams where both Tim and Dee were in the same dream, even though they'd obviously never met. I had to work through a lot of that, and it was a complicated process working through. And Dee and I have now been married for 3 years, and it's wonderful, and it's a relationship I never thought I was going to have. I probably need to say at this moment that I'm bisexual. I've always been attracted to both men and women, because there are people that think I've made this major lifestyle choice, this major lifestyle change. And was I going out with a woman because I was grieving a relationship with a man, or had something so terrible happened in relationship with a man that I only wanted a relationship with a woman? So I have to very quietly and gently explain that, no, I've always shopped around both corners, as somebody said. And so it's not a major lifestyle change. It's another relationship.
And how long are we talking about after Tim died?
It's quite difficult to say exactly when it started, because this was during lockdown. And Dee is a friend of a friend, and we'd met a couple of times at parties and in different social environments. Then during lockdown, Dee is an illustrator, I'm a writer. She was doing a master's, and she wanted a writer to talk through a story with. And so that's how it started. So it started as a work project, effectively. And then when you realise that you're still talking at 1 o'clock in the morning on Zoom, and it's a Wednesday night, it's a school night, and you've got a glass of wine in your hand, you figure that it's more than just that. So we didn't start dating until another of the lockdown gaps. So it was probably 3 years after Tim died that I was thinking about it, and it also wasn't a conscious, I'm going to go on a date with this person. It was something that drifted through friendship into a relationship.
That's what I was about to ask. I was going to ask, was it a surprise?
It kind of was. I'd been thinking about dating apps. Tim and I had known each other since we were very early 20s. And we'd been friends for many years and only got together in my 40s. And then my first husband I met when I was at university. So I'd never done this dating thing. And so I was sitting there thinking, well, if I do want to do this, how do you do this? So fortunately, I never had to go through that.
Well, I'm ever so glad you got another relationship, because I can imagine how comforting that must be to have somebody back in your life.
It is. And we lived for a while in the house that Tim and I had had together. And then we made a decision that we wanted to have a fresh start somewhere that was... Dee had sold her house and moved in with me. And then we decided to pool our resources and buy somewhere that was for us. And we'd originally planned on staying in the area. And then we went on holiday and started looking at right move, like you do when you're on holiday, going, I wonder what's around here. And found the house that we're now living in. And so we're now up in North Yorkshire, completely and utterly fresh start.
It's lovely for you to share all that with me, Suzanne, because that gives people hope, I think, that things don't just necessarily end with death. And I think when it first happens to you, you kind of think your own life's finished. It's like a full stop's been planted firmly.
Absolutely. And it is, it's also, I think, the thing I want to emphasise to people as well is that your new life can be utterly different. Your new life could be with someone, not with someone. It could be in the same house. It could be in a different country or a different county. And again, it's this normalising thing. It's reinforcing that none of those decisions are right or wrong. They're just the decisions you make. And so if you want to spend the rest of your life in a house on the moors with 15 cats, then that is absolutely fine. Just please invite me around for tea because I want to come and meet the cats.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. Let's just give your website a plug. It's the Widow's Handbook.
That's right. It's www.thewidowshandbook.com. But there's also Twitter, Blue Sky, and Facebook.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Suzanne. Very nice to meet you.
Thank you so much, and it's been an absolute delight.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.